This is Chef John Falls welcoming you to Stirring It Up, the best tasting show on radio, and inviting you to join us at the kitchen table for another hour of adventures in food. Each week, we travel from the back roads of Louisiana to the streets of Europe's capitals, delving into food. We'll talk with chefs, food historians, authors, and producers. We'll search out current trends. We'll revive forgotten traditions. And, of course, we may even cook for you. In Louisiana, nose-to-tail cooking means pickled pig's feet, hogshead cheese, calf's liver, and venison heart sausage. Using the odd bits makes delicious eating. Join me, Chef John Falls, and author and chef Jennifer McLaughlin as we talk about cooking the odd bits on Stirring It Up next. But first, the news.
From NPR News in Washington, I'm Windsor Johnston. At the first full day of competition at the Winter Olympics in Sochi today, a Norwegian became the oldest person to win a gold medal in an individual event, and an American snowboarder was a surprise winner in a brand new event. NPR's Eric Westervelt has this roundup.
In winning the men's 10-kilometer biathlon sprint for his seventh career gold medal, 40-year-old Norwegian Ola Einar Bjørndalen became the oldest gold medalist at the Winter Olympics. Fellow Norwegian Marit Bjørgen captured gold in the women's 15K skiathlon. Meantime, American snowboarder Sage Katzenberg put on a unique display of acrobatic twists and turns to win the first U.S. gold. He won the slope-style competition, which made its Olympic debut. Snowboarders are judged for an undefined mix of moves and, quote, overall impression. After winning gold, the 20-year-old from Park City, Utah said, "I just kind of make things up. I kept going and kept it weird. I can't even describe the feeling. It's so cool," he said. Eric Westervelt, NPR News.
A convoy of humanitarian workers in Syria's central city of Homs has managed to escape after coming under fire today. NPR's Alice Fordham reports renewed fighting is undermining a hard-won temporary ceasefire.
The Syrian Arab Red Crescent's cars were shelled and shot at while trying to deliver aid to a rebel-held area. The charity posted a picture on Twitter of a bullet hole in the window of a car and said a driver was injured. Syrian state media said four of the aid workers were hurt. This plan for aid to enter the area is part of a deal between the government and rebel forces. The idea was for any women, children and elderly people who wanted to leave to be evacuated, and food and medicine is meant to come in for those who want to stay. But for the plan to work, there must be a ceasefire. It was not clear who was responsible for the latest violence. The rebels blamed the regime and vice versa. Alice Fordham, NPR News, Beirut.
A fire has broken out in a warehouse at the port of Savannah. The blaze has sent a towering column of black smoke into the air, slowing traffic on a bridge linking the Georgia city to South Carolina. Georgia Ports Authority Chief Operating Officer Griff Lynch says people near the fire who have breathing problems should stay inside.
Evacuation is not necessary. We have talked to the Coastal Health Department, who is also monitoring outside the gates. And they've said that this is a mild irritant, inhalation irritant.
Officials say all workers are accounted for and unharmed. Attorney General Eric Holder says same-sex marriage rights apply to the Justice Department. The department will issue a policy memo to its employees on Monday, instructing them to give same-sex marriages full and equal recognition. This is NPR News in Washington. Filmmaker Woody Allen is responding to accusations by his adopted daughter, Dylan Farrow, that he abused her more than two decades ago. NPR's Julia Bailey reports Allen's response will be published in Sunday's New York Times.
In a long written rebuttal, Woody Allen denies the allegations and blames Mia Farrow, his ex-girlfriend and Dylan's mother, for turning their daughter against him during their custody battle in 1992. Allen was never arrested or prosecuted for sexual abuse, and he outlines the evidence that he believes exonerated him. He then focuses on attacking Mia Farrow, who he says was trying to punish him for falling in love with her then 22-year-old daughter, Soon-Yi Previn. Allen and Previn are now married. Dylan Farrow's letter was published last weekend on New York Times columnist Nicholas Kristof's blog. In it, the now 28-year-old describes her sexual abuse in detail and says she decided to come forward for the first time as an example for other victims. After Allen's response was posted late Friday, Dylan Farrow released a statement on ABC News' website saying she stood by what she wrote. Julia Bailey, NPR News, Washington.
President Obama is highlighting the steps he's planning to take with or without Congress to spur economic activity. He says many of his initiatives are already underway.
Some of them will require Congress. But wherever I can take steps to expand opportunity for more families on my own, I will. I'm going to ask business leaders, education leaders, and philanthropic leaders to partner with us to advance these goals.
In his weekly address, Obama said too many Americans are working harder just to get by. Republicans say he's overreaching by sidestepping Congress. This is NPR.
Support for NPR comes from the George Lucas Educational Foundation, creator of Edutopia, a source for what works in education. Learn more at edutopia.org.
You're listening to KRVS 88.7 FM, Lafayette, Lake Charles, a public service of the University of Louisiana at Lafayette. Find us on Facebook at KRVS Public Media.
Chef John Falls welcoming you to Stirring It Up, the best tasting show on radio. From the swamps and bayous of South Louisiana, thanks for joining us in our little piece of culinary heaven where good cooking is just a way of life. Mornings begin here with a roux simmering in a cast iron pot, and our evenings end with thoughts of what we're going to cook tomorrow. All right, everybody, welcome to Stirring It Up, and thank you so much for sitting around the kitchen table with us today. We're so proud to have all of you. And can you imagine, Michelle York, our executive producer, can you imagine that it's February?
Tick-tock, tick-tock. Time just flying by.
Well, you know, that's why you got to pick up the phone and call that person that you may be at odds with so that you could clear up anything, because time is flying so fast. You don't want to get to a point where you're going to say, I wish I would have done this, but then I got to think you'd be picking up phone talking to me every day.
Well, so, I was thinking vice versa, actually. We'd be on the phone all the time.
That'd be a good thing. Across the glass wall, Dean Slime, our engineer. How's things going over there, Dean?
Oh, man. Things are going.
I don't know how you find music for our show today, because this is a special show. Were you able to find music for this thing?
Oh, just wait. Got some good ones. I'm cooking up. We're brewing up some.
Yeah, because today we have a very, very special show. Anyway, y'all, it's so nice to have all of you here with it. It is a chilly day today, but of course we are in that month. We're about to start thinking about our spring garden planting. The hothouses are full of our tomatoes, at least in my particular case, the greenhouse. And the hogs are fattened.
The hogs are fattened.
Yep, it's boucherie time. If you hadn't done your boucherie by now, you only got a couple more weeks to do it.
Well, you know, you're right.
That's
you're right.
Right.
Exactly. Got to get busy with the boucherie. Otherwise, it's going to be hot again.
And it's going to be Lent. Can't be eating all that hog. Can't be eating all that hog at Lent.
That's right. Well, the good news is Lent is a little later this year than usual.
Well, when is Lent anyway this year? Huh?
I think it's somewhere around March 3rd.
Well, I'm ahead of it anyway. I made 20 pounds of my world famous on doing.
Oh, it's funny, I don't see any to
but,
taste.
But I bet you can smell it on my hands because I just took it out there. I'm gonna give you a little bit of take to the freezer. But don't you have some in your freezer you didn't use from the last batch?
No, I do not. I do not.
Did you use it New Year's for cabbage?
I did. I did chucrut garni. Of course, that was weeks ago. But yeah, I used it all up just in time.
Well, I tell you what, it's that kind of weather, y'all. It is what we refer to as the new season of the year. No, it is not February. It is boucherie season. It's the month of a boucherie. Maybe we'll have to take a ride, you know, Michelle, down to Eunice to see what's going on over at Poche's or Abayas. We may have to go to Eunice Superette down there. I'm sure they got a good supply of everything that comes off the hog, including some jars of oink.
Mm-hmm.
Oh, they got some jars of oink down there waiting for us. Anyway, and like I say, I made me a beautiful batch of andouille, a nice 80-20, well, what I call pork cushion meat is what I use off of the shoulder. Smoked it with pecan wood, a little bit oak, and a couple chips of apple wood. I like to put a little fruit on my smoke. You know?
Is that right?
That's right. And anyway, I got a link for you. I was just kidding. I got a link for you.
Well, you know, you want to go to Eunice, but what about if we just go to Champagne, France, you know, retry some of those andouilles?
Yeah, why don't we do that?
Look, I'd be willing to sacrifice and go to France and try once again those aromatic ondulettes. I think they have them a few times a year. When they have this judging, they have some kind of, I don't think either of us should be a judge.
Y'all, I have to tell you that Michelle and I and a gang were in France a while back and then went to Champagne and they serve hors d'oeuvres, the world famous ondulettes of Lyon. Now, of course, that's all of the casing, all of the, what you would call the gut that's remaining from the boucherie. They take a large middle casing, which is about 2 inches in diameter, and they pull all of the remaining cleaned, of course, gut, intestines, all of that through the center of that one large one, and then they'll put a little light smoke on it or they'll cook it, and then they'll chill it and then slice it as an hors d'oeuvre. So when they slice it, you can imagine it's a 2-inch circle about the thickness of a quarter or a nickel, and in the middle of it is like 100 little circles of the gut that goes through. And it does have a tendency to be a bit aromatic, so to speak. Huh? And Michelle,
in other words, it stinks. Let's just be honest. It stinks. It's not a good aroma.
I want to remind you, though, that some people say cabbage and ondue stink when it's cooking in the kitchen. Huh?
That is child's play next to the sausage.
So you see, stink is not the right word.
Well, go ahead.
Food has identifying aromas that should be enjoyed.
You cannot mistake this one, I can assure you. And they are serious about the sausage. So serious that in the 70s, they formed this society with a big old long name. But anyway, the local producers are awarded certificates from the society for the best ondulette. In the city of Lyon, you just mentioned a while ago, there's a big fan base for ondulette, which rates restaurants, God help us, based on the quality of their ondulette.
Well, you know, Michelle, my brother called me the other day.
If that were the case, I wouldn't eat anywhere. I'm sorry.
Michelle.
Anyway.
Michelle, you see, ondulette is a regional specialty that people grow up with, that they love, and whenever they travel around the world, like Louisianians who bring that little bottle of hot sauce with them. My brother called me the other day and said, boy, do I have a treat for you. And I said, what? He said, come by my house. I have a raccoon gumbo. And I said, oh, my God, you have to be kidding. Where did you get a raccoon to make a gumbo? He said, well, we killed two of them.
Roadside?
I ran as fast as I could, endangering the lives of fellow travelers on the highway to go eat what from my childhood is one of the delicacies of a Cajun cabin, and that is a smoked raccoon gumbo. Now, if I was in Lyon and I told these fellas who's making the ondulette, which you say, you know, has a special aroma to it and should not be allowed out of Lyon, if I was to tell them about sitting at my table of raccoon gumbo, I might get a like response that you have. So you see, it's all about regional specialists. Well, look at hogshead cheese. Look at Ponce, the stuffed stomach of the pig in Cajun country, which you can get at all the restaurants. It's not that much different. It's just that.
Okay, appearance-wise, no. But aroma-wise, yes. You cannot, you know.
I see.
You cannot smell it before you see it.
So in other words, you're not an aficionado, so to speak.
Not a ondulette. Or you get it right there, kind of.
You know, ondulette is an acquired taste, no doubt about it.
It
has quite a strong aroma that you might find a little off-putting, I guess, if you're not from the area. The texture is rougher and certainly tougher than our local ondulette, since the contents of the small intestines of the pig or whether it's the calf or whatever
There's ondulette. And then there's ondulette.
That's right. That's
there shall the twain meet.
No, well, that's true, too. And that's why I was about to say that the small intestines are put into the large intestines. In many cases, it's coarsely chopped. It's not ground as we do with our meat. It's mainly sliced and pan-fried, but it can also be boiled or grilled or something. It's often served with vegetables and mainly onions and mustard to disguise the taste and flavor. I'm sure a little red wine sauce goes with it. And, of course, as with the French, it has to be accompanied by a great white, like a Chablis or Champagne of the area.
Absolute must.
It's using every part of the animal to make something delicious. Now, that's where the controversy comes from with the French coming to Louisiana and getting a chicken and andouille gumbo. Immediately their taste buds start to salivate as they're thinking about their regional andouillette of Lyon. And then they get this smoked coarse sausage that we make all throughout the river parishes. And they say, well, what is this stuff? This isn't andouillette. So you see, look.
And next thing we know, they're looking for a residence.
When in Rome.
Now, I've got to say, I do agree with you on that. When in Rome, do as the Romans. Try the regional specialties of the area that you're in. I fully believe that. Certainly nothing new to us here, especially when you consider the boucheries. And since andouillette absolutely covers the tail end, I'll say, what about the other end? We talk about the head cheese. You mentioned it a while ago.
Fromage de tête de cochon.
That's right. Not cheese at all. Fromage comes from the Latin root word forma, which means to form or to be pressed into a shape, which is how the cheese is made. For head cheese, the meat of the head is actually chopped, mixed with other ingredients, and formed into a little shape for slicing. Delicious. Yeah. There is as many versions of hogshead cheese, really, as there are as many gumbo recipes. What? We've done a little tasting across South Louisiana before, comparing hogshead cheese from place to place, and there are a lot of differences.
Well, it depends how it's cut. It depends whether it's ground. It depends whether it's hand-chopped, whether there's going to be some crunchy morsels in it that might be made of some meat that has sinew in it, or whether it's more gelatin. Head cheese is delicious, y'all, a true Louisiana delicacy. But as Michelle was saying about the andouillette, it is an acquired taste for many people. It's a process that takes a couple of days due to the brining or the cooking. A lot of Cajun families put a little shot of vinegar in their hogshead cheese while they're making it. Other people
To cut the fat,
and a lot of other people feel that if vinegar's in a dish, it should have a pickle in it or something. It shouldn't be in meat. But pickled meat is a big part of French and Louisiana, Spanish, Italian customs, which we have so many. You won't find this dish in too many parts of the country. I mean, this hogshead cheese is a perfect example of the head-to-tail cooking that we do here. Odd bits, so mm-hmm. to speak.
And using more of the part, some people I've heard actually add the ear to the hogshead.
Well, of course,
that's
where the crunchy comes from, see? And a little more gelatin, too.
Okay, gelatin is what I had in mind. Or sometimes they poach the ears or even grill them. I love this quote from Calvin Schwab in his book, Unmentionable Cuisine. He said, perhaps you cannot make a silk purse out of a sow's ear, but you can make some tasty hors d'oeuvres or a supper dish.
He's exactly right, too. Exactly right. And don't forget the tongue, the very tender, rich, and smooth piece of meat that's found inside, almost like a tenderloin to be exact, inside of the rough outer coating of the tongue. And, of course, it still has to be boiled. And once it's boiled, then you can peel off the taste buds, the coarse outer side of the tongue, and on the inside is this really beautiful, tender, or like I say, almost a tenderloin of meat inside. You can still see odd bits, as we call it, like this, sold in most specialty markets, but you probably will never find any of this except possibly chicken livers and gizzards is about as adventuresome as the grocery stores will get, normally speaking.
Yeah.
If you're looking for pig's head, or you're looking for pig's feet, or you're looking for pig's tail, or even sheep or goat, or let me tell you something. You have to go to some of the more traditional countryside markets, which unfortunately are disappearing. And I think everybody knows what we're talking about today. We're talking about odd bits, and what do you do with them? Because in old days, you didn't even throw away the oink.
Matter. Gizzards and hot sauce got texture and taste. You can eat some now, save the rest for fish bait.
Glide through your weekday mornings at 11 a.m. here on the Medicine Ball Caravan. I'm Cecil Doyle. Mondays through Thursdays, we cruise through a fast-paced hour of sounds, both old and new, as well as keeping you up to date with area music and arts. The Medicine Ball Caravan, 11 to noon weekdays here on KRVS.
Hi, this is Nick Forster. Every week in E-Town, we bring together musicians from a wide range of styles for some great live performances and conversation. And we also present the Achievement Award to someone doing outstanding work in their communities. It's an hour of uplifting stories and music each week on E-Town.
Tuesday at noon on KRVS.
Some of our music on the Thistle and Shamrock is very old. Some is brand new, like the Festival and Soundtrack Commissions and the new songs we discover on our radio programmes. Uncover a wealth of new music this week.
Coming up Sunday evening at 6, here on KRVS.
Visit the KRVS website for programming information, live streaming audio, podcasts of locally produced programming, and world news from NPR Digital. It's all at krvs.org. This is KRVS 88.7 FM, Lafayette, Lake Charles.
When I got up this morning, I couldn't even tie my shoes. Ooh-wee, babe, I think I've got a real bad case of chillin' blues.
All right, everybody, welcome back to Stirring It Up, the best-tasting food and culture show on radio. And it's so nice to have all of you around the kitchen table today. I cannot even believe that the year is flying by so fast, so fast. I cannot believe it, Michelle York, huh?
I know.
Michelle, how about introducing our good friend back to the big show?
Absolutely. Well, we have Jennifer McLaughlin back with us today. You'll remember that a couple of weeks ago she joined us on our Fat Show. And she was so spectacular. We had such a good time, and we were already planning a show on doing odd bits, as we've been saying. And since she wrote the book on it, why not have her again today? You'll remember that Jennifer is also the author of, as I mentioned, Fat, but also Bone. So we could be doing a Bone show before too long as well. As a chef, Jennifer spent time in the kitchens of Melbourne, Australia, London, England. She was chef at Winfield House for the U.S. Ambassador to the Court of St. James in England. She's a regular contributor to magazines like Fine Cooking, Food and Drink, and of course many other culinary publications. She's presented at prestigious food festivals such as Food and Wine Classic in Aspen and the Melbourne Food and Wine Festival, the Masterclass Series. She's been referred to as courageous, as contrarian, and even a little crazy, and we love her for every bit of it. We're so happy to have her back on the show to talk about odd bits. Jennifer, welcome to Stirring It Up. Thank you for being with us today.
Thanks, Michelle. I'm really happy to be back. You know, it's nice for you to invite a fat, odd person like me onto the show.
So we're fair distance from the holidays now, but just out of curiosity, did you prepare any of your odd bit recipes for the holiday table?
Well, I always have a tradition of making it kind of a classy odd bit. I make a terrine of foie gras.
Oh.
I make that every year, and that's something that I always make. And a little bit more down home, I guess, I use those giblets and things from if I'm roasting a bird. I always make the gravy using those, and I love to keep the neck when I'm roasting a bird. You know, some people just roast that and throw it away, but it's pretty good eating on a neck.
You're talking to John's heart right now.
Jennifer, there's a rule in Louisiana. If I'm at the table and there's a neck in the room, don't even look at it. It's mine. Look, I do Christmas, Thanksgiving, holiday dinners every year for a group of nuns over at a convent in Baton Rouge, and they're really good friends, and I just love them to death. And one of the nuns, like I, love the necks of chicken or capon or any kind of bird. So we've created a tradition about, how many years ago, Michelle?
Probably five years ago,
we created a tradition that on holidays, I bring them a beautiful bird that's all roasted with the trimmings, and then we split the neck in half, she and I, and we eat it standing up by the kitchen sink.
Yeah, well, the sharing part kind of got out of hand, so he added extra necks this year.
I know people are saying, is he kidding me that he actually cooks extra necks? Well, Jennifer, you know exactly what I'm talking about.
You know, I was in the grocery store the other day, and I saw in my little grocery store, they actually have packs of turkey necks now, along with the pig feet.
Split pig feet, yeah.
So I thought, Jennifer needs to come visit. We're catching up.
No, that's good. You know, the trouble is now when you buy a bird, it doesn't come with everything anymore. It's hard to find the neck and the giblets and the liver and the kidneys. They're all taken out and put somewhere else, right? You know, those necks are delicious, though. They're, you know, people just don't realize how good they are, and you can chew on that bone and, I'm getting hungry.
Well, you know, I think that's what makes your book Odd Bits, and we've been talking about it a little bit. Certainly it's a part of our library, as you know already. But, you know, growing up where I grew up anyway, this was mainstream. Odd Bits certainly is the name today, but to think of the boucheries we did at my grandfather's house where we slaughtered two or three pigs at a time, or a little calf in the spring, or even a lamb, certainly wild game, the hearts, the liver, the kidneys, the lights, the lungs, the tongue, I mean, these were the delicacies of this era. What happened? Why is it that people, even in my restaurant today where we do tripe and we do tongue and we do liver for Sunday brunch, smothered liver with onions and a nice brown gravy over grits in the South was a tradition. What's happened? Why are people walking away from this?
You know, I think there's a couple of reasons. I think probably meat has become very cheap, you know, with factory farming and all those other horrible things that have gone on. Meat is cheap and people see it, you know, as a steak or a loin is more prestigious than the other part of the animal. And then when they don't eat those parts, they're not familiar with them. And when they're not familiar with them, they're kind of scared, you know, that they don't know what they are. They think they're going to be weird tasting or odd. And, you know, there is only one heart in an animal, and that's one of the best cuts out of there. But people don't understand that. You know, it's more tasty than the fillet of the animal, I think. So it's just, you know, people have got further away from their food, and those things don't look that good packaged in the supermarket, you know?
No, it's true. People
don't buy them, right? And they don't go to butcher stores anymore, and there's only certain parts of the animals for sale, and the rest seem to disappear somewhere. I asked a big meat packing company in Canada, and they said they shipped them all to Asia because the Asians were crazy for them and would pay a higher price, right?
And that may have also been part of the reason they've disappeared from the stores, is that there's another market that's opened up that's become financially viable for them to ship in these areas. But it just seems to me that as I grew up, I'll never forget the delicacy, the rare delicacy. Again, I'll mention the boucherie because it's so vividly painted in my mind, all of the family getting together around these huge cast iron pots over wood fires, boiling water, scraping the hogs or whatever. And the delicacy of the day, the prize at the end of the day was when my grandfather would take the head of the pig out of the boiling pot with the skin and the feet and the ears to make the head cheese. He would take this little hatchet and kind of break the skull in half and break it in two and sit there and allow the children to come up and eat the brains that were cooked with all of this seasoning. It had been poaching in this liquid for hours and picking up all this great flavor as the meat was pulled off of the cheeks of the animal to make the head cheese. The brains were taken out fully flavored, and it was for the kids to eat and enjoy. Now think about that today.
That's interesting. And then you're familiar, you see that as a kid, and it doesn't seem odd or strange or scary to you, you know. And today everyone's so far removed from how animals are raised that, you know, they see a head and they go, ooh. They don't want to think that animals have heads and tails and feet, right? They want to think of them as like loins and chops. But there is all those parts of the animal. And, you know, with the diminishing resources and how we live in the world today, we should really think about eating the whole animal. That's the best way we can show respect to an animal, is to eat it from nose to tail, not just eat parts of it, but eat every part of it.
In Michelle and I's research on some of our books, there was a fabulous, fabulous line that had been documented. I think it may have been right at Williamsburg on that first Thanksgiving, where the governor had written a note about the Indians on that particular day kind of being horrified when the turkey and the venison were being brought together to be cooked. And they said, no, the animals have given their life for us and they need to be respected. And you cannot cook the animals together because it would be just disrespect to them. And there was this whole paragraph written about how the Indians said they had to pay homage to the to the Great Father and ask forgiveness for putting these two carcasses together, because it showed a lack of respect for not only the animal who had given its life, but the fact that the treatment of it was insignificant, and they were very upset about it. And I think about that so often, about what, you know, animals do. In fact, we raise animals to give their lives for us, and how can you not think of the organ meats? Nothing makes a better gravy, nothing has a better flavor than a stuffed heart that's pot roasted in a cast iron pot with all of the vegetables braised. I mean, it's incredible. I think some of the best flavors are coming from these pieces.
Yeah, I totally agree. And it's interesting because it's just disappeared from our tables probably in the last 20 years because, you know, I've got, it's not an exotic cookbook, but Joy of Cooking, right? And in my issue of Joy of Cooking, which is like dated in the 80s, right, because they keep reissuing that book, there's recipes for tripe and liver and kidneys and even coxcombs and testicles, right?
Right, sure.
And, I mean, that's not an exotic cookbook, right? And we've all forgotten that people ate all those foods and they made them tasty and delicious. And now people go, ooh, no, no, that's too weird. But I don't think it's any weirder to eat a cow, you know, a beef cheek than a beef bottom. You know, a piece of rump.
No, of course. You're exactly. Look, I remember the first time I sat at a beautiful plate. In fact, it was in France at La Tour d'Argent. I sat down and ate, and I had the coq au vin. And on the plate was the foot and the coxcomb.
Mm-hmm.
And I thought to myself right then, it was almost presented on the plate as the half bird in its entire form. The neck was there and everything else. And I thought to myself, I hadn't seen that before as an American chef. But seeing that for the first time as a young chef, I was in my 20s, I thought to myself, my God, how spectacular this is. I know that this is a chicken. I understand it.
Yeah.
I remember the coxcomb from when we did our chicken fricassees, and I remember the feet of the chicken going into the pot because it gave the gravy that great gelatinous flavor, that good viscosity that no other part of the bird could give that gravy. And that is, Jennifer, what I think is missing, the understanding that each one of these parts contributes so unbelievably to the unique flavor of a dish.
Exactly. It adds flavor, taste, and texture. And I think that's what's really important.
You know, last year, Jennifer, John and I had an opportunity to go to Israel to tour the Holy Land. And the first day that we got there was the only day we were in Tel Aviv. So we went to the marketplace, Carmel Market, storming, very cold, cold, rainy day. But we made our way there, and it was so interesting to see the meat section of the market. There were heads of beef, and there were lamb's heads in the long shank bones and the hooves of the animals. It was quite an experience, actually, walking through that market. And you could see that the people certainly used all parts of the animal, and don't we wish that we would have more of that here. One of the things you mentioned earlier was tongue. It used to be really commonplace in kitchens, and in fact, I was reading just yesterday, we're doing some research for our new vegetable book, and in researching the vegetables and learning about foods of the Bible, one of the things that they mentioned was lamb's tongue. And I saw that you had a recipe in your Odd Bits book about that. I don't ever think about lamb's tongue, but tongue in general is a delicacy.
Oh, tongue is just one of those fabulous pieces of meat my mother always made for Christmas in Australia, because of course it's hot there. Ox tongue, or pressed ox tongue, and of course it wasn't an ox, it's a beef tongue, but it was put into jelly, right, the jelly from the cooking, and then she would turn it out and cut it into slices so we'd have cold tongue and jelly at Christmas. Tongue has this wonderful, creamy, wonderful texture. And, you know, I discovered writing the book because I'd always had tongue cold. I think of it like pastrami or something, right, cold. But hot tongue, which I love to say, hot tongue is absolutely delicious. It takes on a different texture when it's hot, right? And it's great. You can put it on the barbecue. You can cook it in all different sorts of ways. But people go, when they see a tongue, they go, ooh, because it looks like the tongue in your mouth, right? So that kind of turns them off a little bit. But that's a shame because it's a fabulous piece of meat, and it's just meat. It's just a muscle.
How hard is it to cook tongue? You know, a couple of years ago, I got adventurous one day. I have to catch up with you and John on the adventure of the unusual pieces of meat that we're not as accustomed to using today. But I did cook stomach you know, and a heart.
Oh. You cooked a stuffed pasta.
And then one time, remember, you got the hearts for me, and I did a braised heart dish. And I have to say that after I finished cooking it, I had trouble eating it, and I'm sorry to say, I'm getting there. Y'all have to be patient with me. But how hard is it to cook tongue?
Tongue is really easy to cook. In fact, it's probably pretty much foolproof. You know, I'm not one for pressure cookers or anything like that, but you just put it in a pot and you cook it until it's cooked, right? And it takes a while, a couple of hours, depending on the size of the tongue. And then the only tricky bit is peeling the outside skin off. That's that bumpy skin, and then, you know, you can't really overcook tongue, I don't think, right? You can, and then you've got this beautiful piece of meat that you can have cold, or then you can slice it and then grill it, or you can serve it hot with a sauce. And, you know, I've got that lamb's tongue recipe, and lamb's tongues are delicious, but they're a lot more work because you have to peel more tongues. If you do like a beef tongue, there's only one thing to peel, right?
I love tongue myself, and it's so simple to do. And just to put that tongue in a pot of water or stock with vegetables and bring it to a boil or simmer, as you say, for a couple of hours until that outer skin that has kind of the taste buds on, that coarse skin, that outer part of the tongue, when that's peel off, which comes off almost like a sock off of your foot, once it's all boiled, it peels off pretty easily. Inside is this magnificent tenderloin-type-looking piece of meat. And once it's sliced nice and put across a platter with a nice sauce on it, most of my guests would think that it's tenderloin. Everybody would say, "Oh, you got beautiful tenderloin here today," when in fact it's tongue, and I do serve it hot or cold.
Yeah, it's absolutely sliced up. You know, people have no idea. I saw this old French recipe where they had the lamb's tongues around this pile of rice, and that wasn't very attractive, but when you slice it up, or, you know, I say to someone, have it in a sandwich. I mean, like pastrami or something, you know, a hot tongue sandwich is delicious, right? I mean, like there's so many ways, and it's just pure meat. And the other thing about tongue, I'm not sure down there, but up here it's extremely cheap to buy.
Right, it is. One of the things, Jennifer, that as a young boy, there were about five, we were poor as church rats, as we used to say, you know, I mean, but there were about three or four very wealthy families in the neighborhood. And when I say the neighborhood, when you get a chance to come and visit us, our neighborhood is pretty swampy and swampland, cabin and Cajun culture down here. It's really beautiful, beautiful, serene place. But the only time I ever heard of a tongue being presented on a formal table was at the wealthy folks' house. You see, we always had our tongue when we did the boucheries. We boil them. There was only one tongue per animal, so it went pretty quick, kind of as our lunch that day, because we would take it out of the head cheese pot that had been boiling for 3 or 4 hours. And that tongue would be consumed in 5 minutes. It would be gone. And you never heard of the tongue again until the next boucherie. But at our wealthy neighbor's home, the girls would say, "Oh, today we're having tongue sandwich or something." It was like, "Oh, well, it's not even boucherie season. Where are they getting the tongue from?" Jennifer, do you think that a lot of this has to do with the disappearing old-time meat markets, where you could actually go and just have this kaleidoscope of opportunity to buy every cut of meat possible? Do you think that's why we're having such problem with some of these lesser cuts, let's say?
Yeah, I think so. I think because people can't find them easily and they don't see them, so they're not familiar with them. They don't know what they are. And then if they do want to get them, it's kind of difficult. So I think that contributes. But I also find there's a lot of people who are buying, you know, like half an animal, a quarter of an animal directly from a farmer. And then they end up with these bits that they don't know what to do anything with. You know, they're not sure how to cook them. And so I find those people are interested in cooking tongue and brains and ears and all those kind of things.
I cooked in China. I tell Michelle all the time, when I was in China, I came to really have a great respect for the culture there. That said, if an animal only has one, then it is served to the guest of honor. So the tongue would go to the guest of honor, the liver to the guest of honor. The primal cuts were the last and less significant, because they were more of it, and you could get a piece of meat, but you only one tongue, or only 2 feet on the chicken. I think that was a really interesting part of the culture, is that if you're honored, you get the thing that takes the least opportunity to enjoy. I thought that was unbelievable. Jennifer, can you hold over just for a minute? We're going to take us a quick little break, and we'll be right back. Y'all, you don't want to miss anything else Jennifer has to say. This is fun.
Give you folks a warning. I mean to this morning, and I want you all to strictly understand. I'm going to tell you something to strictly understand. Now you can call me what you choose, but I'm a bird liver craving man.
I want to see you at high noon. Noontime, Thursdays on KRVS 88.7. For rock, roll, rhythm, it's old gold on KRVS. An hour on Thursdays at noontime. Isley Kleinpeter with an invite to join me Thursdays at noon on KRVS 88.7 for Fats Domino, Chuck Berry, Elvis, Carl Perkins, even Dolly Parton.
Swing music is beloved all over the world, but what is its connection to Africa? Join me, Georges Collinet, for Reimagining Africa, from popular swing to the jazz avant-garde. Next time on Afropop Worldwide from PRI, Public Radio International.
Sunday night at 8 on KRVS.
Hi, this is Bill Bowens from The Dirty Rice Show, inviting you to join either Mr. Lee Kleinpeter or myself every Saturday night from 8:30 p.m. until 10 p.m. for Dirty Rice right here on KRVS 88.7 FM, Lafayette, Lake Charles, public radio for Acadiana.
You're listening to KRVS 88.7 FM, Lafayette, Lake Charles, online at krvs.org.
That was close, Slum. At least you got heart. Well, I guess it is to eat your heart out, right?
Yeah, not for that, yeah, right.
Welcome back, everybody, to Stirring It Up in the Best Tasting Show, the Odd Bit Show today. And, of course, we have our great friend from Toronto, where I just found out it is like minus 21 Celsius up there, Michelle. You talk about could set some hog cheese up there today.
Oh, goodness gracious. Jennifer, we've been skipping around talking about some different odd bits. We've talked a little bit about heart and tongue and that kind of thing. But what are we missing? What are some of the other odd bits that we should think about and are underused or underutilized pieces of meat?
I think, you know, when people think of odd bits, they always think about, like, the offal or the variety meats, like the liver and the kidney and the tongue and the brain, which I love. But there's also other things like oxtail, like the beef tail, or the neck of the animal, like we were talking about the turkey necks and the chicken necks before. But, you know, lamb neck and venison neck and cuts like that are absolutely delicious. And then the shanks and the cheeks of the animal, and I mean the cheeks in the head. You know, when you make the head cheese, you have the pork cheeks, but beef cheeks are a wonderful braising cut that braises beautifully. It makes a very gelatinous sauce, and it doesn't shred or fall apart when you cook it for a long time. It's absolutely delicious.
Jennifer, I remember when working in England, how we did a couple of these historic dinners, and how beautiful it was when that boar's head or when that oxen's head or beef head was brought up to the table fully roasted and decorated as part of the early traditions, and certainly served to royalty. So obviously the place that these parts of an animal took on the tables in those days versus the way we would view them today is totally from A to Z, wouldn't you say?
Yeah, I think, you know, if you went to a dinner now and they presented you a roasted boar's head on the table, you might be a bit shocked. But as you say, that's a very good English tradition. In fact, it was served at the feasts for kings and queens and royal weddings. They served this roasted boar's head, which was a sign of, like, power, because, you know, hunting a wild boar is quite a dangerous thing, especially in those times. And if you could kill the boar, then you would celebrate that by roasting its head and presenting it to all the people, right? And it's a tradition that's carried on in certain colleges and universities in the UK and even around the world, but Alas, now they often just use a pig's head and they put some pieces of celery instead of the tusk, so it doesn't really have quite the most
right.
the presence that it used to have. But, you know, there's something about that, the animal's head, you know, like that's very in-your-face way of celebrating that, you know, you've taken this animal's life and, you're going to celebrate it in another way by presenting the head.
Now, you mentioned something that really struck me just now, and that is oxtail and the unbelievable flavor of a delicious oxtail soup or braised oxtail, or even, my God, one of the dishes that is probably as high up on the ladder of notoriety at our fine dining restaurant. And, of course, that's the shanks of the animal. Even the venison shanks that we're serving right now are just absolutely incredible. And, of course, the added benefit is that unbelievable marrow bone in the center.
Yeah, you get that double whammy, right? You get that wonderful, tasty meat, the sweetest meat is close to the bone, like a shank, and then inside is the marrow that, you know, so many people just leave inside the bone.
Oh. Look, I remember 8 children in my home fighting desperately to see who was going to get the soup bone to suck the marrow out of the vegetable soup pot. I have a long tradition of, as we say, sucking marrow. Well, you know, even the pomp and circumstance that is served in our restaurant Revolution in New Orleans, every shank that comes to the dining room has that beautiful silver spoon with the small tip on one end and the nice little shovel end on the other, sticking out of the marrow bone about a foot high in air, glistening, beautifully polished silver, just to remind our guests that this is a very special piece of meat, so special, in fact, that a tool is made specifically to enjoy it. And the long marrow bones that we actually roast in our wood-fired ovens, again, one of the top-selling items on our menu, and I think you may have a lot to do with that in many ways, just reminding people through your own books and through your own work that these are the delicacies of the past that we've thrown so insignificantly on the sidelines, but yet are making a big comeback today. Don't you see it?
Oh, yeah, exactly. Like roasted marrow bones are one of the really popular items in restaurants today, right? And that wonderful, and I'll say it's mainly unsaturated fat in that marrow, is absolutely delicious. Plus, it's really good for you. And I'm thrilled to learn you have those special spoons, because that's a rarity to find marrow spoons these days. You know, that I've been looking for ages, and I've never found any good ones. So I'm coming down, and I'll probably just sneak out of the restaurant with one in my handbag, right?
Well, look, I'll tell
you. It's happened before.
a quick story. An Italian chef who served a shank to me in St. Louis, Missouri, at Tony's restaurant, Vince Bomarito, one of the top chefs in the United States coming from Italy. He served this shank to me with this Sheffield silver marrow spoon sticking out of the bone. And it was like a lightning bolt that hit me right between the eyes when I saw how beautiful the presentation was. I had no clue what this spoon was about. I had never seen one before. And he came and he took the spoon out and put it on the plate, and he says, enjoy the marrow first. And I'll never forget that moment when I came to understand how significant the marrow was in the center of that. And immediately I got the name of the company in England where I could get the spoons from. I remember they were $125 each, and I bought 20 of them, which was almost at the mortgage something to buy that in those days. And I put them in the restaurant, and today, so many years later, I want you to know, Jennifer, I still have every one of those spoons.
It's such a wonderful way to extract the marrow out, and then spreading it on the toast with a little salt, or just eating it straight off the spoon. And you do want to eat that marrow first, because you want it to be hot when you eat it, right? It's just such a wonderful fat. Oh, it's so delicious.
Jennifer, what would you suggest is a good starting place for those who might be interested in starting to cook with Odd Bits, who might be a little tentative about it? Where's a good place to start?
Well, I guess there's two ways, Michelle. They could start with something like what John and I have been talking about, like shanks, you know, which are kind of not too scary to cook. You can just braise them in any kind of way you like. I mean, any stew or braised recipe you can put in a shank. But if they're a bit more adventurous, maybe like you, they can try the heart. But I wouldn't suggest that they cook it whole, because that's sometimes a little intimidating. You know, heart can be cooked like a steak very quickly and kept rare in the inside. You can, like, make it into a stir fry. Or if you're a bit more adventurous, one of my favorite ways to eat heart is as tartare.
Oh, now, if you my like steak, goodness.
If you like steak tartare, it's just raw meat, but you'll find that heart has so much more flavor.
Look, this is worth the whole show. When I get
heart tartare. Oh, I can see it on the Valentine's Day menu.
Look, I assure you I will be eating that within the next couple of days. I've never had heart tartare. Never.
How perfect for Valentine's Day would it be?
Yeah.
Oh, my God. So, yeah, I agree with that totally. But, Jennifer, we're running out of time. I could talk to you for a week, and I hope we get a chance to do that in the near future when you want to get out of the cold and come south. By the way, I'm planning a trip in the next month or so to come up to Toronto. We're looking at a couple seafood restaurants. We're going to call you before we come up because we need to take you to dinner.
Well, I can make you a nice soup with, like, a pork hock in there and some split peas, and that'll warm you up.
Forget the dinner. We're coming your way, okay? Jennifer, thanks so much, and I know it's a month late, but Happy New Year to you, and we look so forward to seeing you in person and hosting you here in Louisiana. Whenever you want to escape that weather, we have a place for you, and you'll be treated just as you are, family, okay?
Well, Happy New Year to you, and may there be lots of odd bits and fat in 2014.
We're proponents and we're advocates for you, so it will be on our table for sure. Thank you so much, Jennifer. We appreciate it. All right, everybody. Now it's time for a book or two. Michelle, what are you going to be mentioning here?
Well, of course.
For the library.
Of course, we're going to start with Odd Bits. Jennifer's book, Jennifer McLaughlin, Odd Bits, How to Cook the Rest of the Animal. Of course, we love her other books as well, Fat, which we featured a few weeks ago, Bones, and then, of course, Odd Bits. Jennifer exposes the parts of the animal that used to be consumed before they became taboo. We've discussed some of those today, and she discusses in the book why we should consider putting these parts back on the menu. In her introduction, I think it's kind of funny, Jennifer says, "Trust me." When it comes to cooking and eating odd bits of animals. And you would have to put some trust in her and be a little adventurous to go out there. But I think if you're going to do it, she's the best teacher for it. She grew up eating tongue, liver, ears, and so much more. And many of us are familiar with that here in Louisiana. Great book, Odd Bits. The other book that I want to mention today is Unmentionable Cuisine. It was written by Calvin Schwab. This book's been out for a number of years and covers the odd bits that Jennifer discussed and more. It's a worldwide look at the origins of eating certain meats, certain animals, fish parts, and how and why consumption of others kind of fell out of favor. Calvin takes us on a tour of animal parts with accompanying recipes and talks about what parts of the world in which they are commonly eaten. His main objective is to help eliminate food prejudices, to be adventurous, and to encourage the reader to try the unmentionable parts to add variety and nutrition to their diet. So that might be something interesting for everybody to think about as we begin this new year. It's a time of new beginnings, and maybe this is a time to try something a little bit new for your plate. So both of these books will be on our website. Great additions to your culture and culinary library, Odd Bits, and also Unmentionable Cuisine.
Those are fantastic, and both of them wonderful, wonderful books just to sit and cuddle with, too, and just kind of read a little bit. Yeah, just turn the pages. I mean, just really great, great books. Looking at Odd Bits, for example, you know, to see the beautiful photography in it is just incredible. Salama, what about the website? What about our Facebook page? Anything interesting?
Yeah, we got some of our friends. They're saying hi on Facebook. Like to let everybody know we have a little social media footprint. But Steve Bales out there from Simi Valley, California, says, "Hey, John, he's been cooking your recipes for a good while now. He's glad he found us on Facebook." But yeah, come on by on our Facebook. I mean, we are taking Stovehound suggestions for show topics, and we're always looking to see what y'all are doing out there, see what is cooking in the kitchen, and we're always thrilled to see the photos that people are posting on Facebook. We do a lot of photo posting ourselves, so you can come on by and see what we're cooking. But, you know, come on, be part of the community, Stovehounds.
We really would like your comments on the show, and we'd like some show suggestions as well.
And so that's facebook.com/stirringitupradio.
Michelle, do you want me to do a recipe for sausage stuffed heart, or do you want liver and onions? Which one do you want? Sausage stuffed venison heart or venison liver? It's game season now, you know?
Well, what about the liver and onions?
You like that?
I do. Or do you prefer the sausage?
No, I love them both. I mean, the venison liver and onions, I mean, there's a lot of hunters out there, and yeah. I was throwing away liver, right? And nothing is better served, especially at the hunting camp breakfasts, than the smothered venison liver and onions over a plate of hot grits with a fried egg on top of it. No better way to make use of a fresh venison liver, especially during this hunting season. The good news about it is you cook it the same way you would cook any other liver. I take about a pound and a half of a venison liver, and of course you want to slice it very thin. When you see liver in the store, it's normally sliced, you know, about a quarter of an inch thick. And I would always recommend that you take the liver and put it in the freezer for an hour or so to firm it up. That way it's easier to slice when there's kind of ice crystals in it, not frozen, but mm-hmm. almost frozen, that you can still slice through it, you know, without it kind of yeah. falling apart on you. That's the way most of us slice liver in the restaurants. We kind of freeze it just enough to firm it up, not to get it solid. And then we can cut through it just like you would head cheese almost, you know.
So does that work for, like, calf's liver? When I've bought calf's liver, which is so tender, it's hard for me to separate pieces, and I make a mess.
Well, normally what you want to do with liver in general, it's so much easier in the store to buy it already pre-sliced, even though you're going to pay a little bit more money for it. If you buy a whole piece, then absolutely do the same thing. Put it in the freezer. But what I normally do is put it in the freezer and set my timer for 30 minutes. And then mm-hmm. I feel it if it looks like it's kind of hardening. Not hardening, because it's not going to freeze in a half hour, but it'll firm up. Mm-hmm. And then you can take it out right away, put it on a cutting board, and you can slice right through it. You know, and that gives you also an opportunity to remove a lot of the membranes and things like that. I'm going to saute 10 slices of bacon, render all of that fat with 2 tablespoons of vegetable oil. The bacon's going to give it that nice, wonderful smoky flavor. Do not burn or brown. Take the bacon out and chop it real fine, or you can leave it in whole slices if you wish, but now the 2 tablespoons of vegetable oil will be flavored by that bacon. Then I'm going to take the venison slices, put them out, season them with salt, pepper, and granulated garlic, not garlic powder, granulated garlic. It's the coarser, dehydrated garlic. I'm going to put 2 cups of lightly seasoned flour in a pan, and then I'm going to dip the liver in the flour, and don't overcrowd the skillet. Use a nice big skillet. Put about 3 strips of liver down in there. They cook very quickly. Liver is not something that you need to cook an hour. I mean, you just put it in there and you brown it on all sides. And once it's brown, you're going to take 2 onions that have been very thinly sliced, and you're going to put them down in that oil and just fry it until they smother down. And once they smother all the way down, you add a little bit of stock into it, and you put the liver back on top, and you just warm it back up again. Then you just serve, of course, a generous portion of the pan drippings and the onions on top of the liver. Recipe, along with other recipes, on our Facebook page, y'all. Hey, go out there and experiment with a few odd bits and shock the neighbors. We'll see you next week.
Hi, everyone. This is Pat Mitchell-Worley, and coming up next time on Bill Street Caravan, we've got the Reverend John Wilkins and the Sly Brothers. That's all coming up next time on Bill Street Caravan.
Saturday night at 11 here on KRVS.
Explorations into the world of the harp guitar, this week on Harpistry. Tune in Sunday at midnight and Monday at noon, right here on KRVS.
This is KRVS, 88.7 FM, Lafayette, Lake Charles.